we're speaking about maverick scholars and people being looked upon as maverick. This is usually a term of negativity to try to ostracize them in some way. So there are a lot of people writing, I would call them aficionados, who have taken up the cause and are publishing books on their own and through different means of publishing at the moment. And this is making a fairly big impression on the internet. So it may turn out that what are called mavericks now and generations to come, hopefully, can at least be a counterweight to some of the scholarship. The scholarship, unfortunately, people in the field of studying these kind of documents, gospels and other materials of that kind, often come from seminaries or rabbinical institutions. And very often where the scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls were concerned, these were people who were under authority. So you really couldn't get an objective view or to go beyond a certain point from them. They could go this far and no further, but they couldn't see, for instance, if you said the scrolls are really what Christianity was in Palestine, they couldn't go that far. I'm somewhat of a pessimist. I feel that the authoritative documents are so authoritative in people's minds that even though new points of view come into play, it takes people maybe 30, 40 years of their life to develop these attitudes and points of view, and it's very difficult to pass it on to a new generation. So when young people or a new generation come up, they just start with the same documents that they had in the first place, and the same authoritative points of view hold sway. And I'm not sure if in 2100 or 2200, we won't be looking at the same allegiances that we're seeing now. We're speaking about the Messianic movement in Palestine. I think that I coined that phrase maybe back in the mid-80s, the 1980s, because when we were looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls, people were using the Dead Sea Scrolls to talk about Essenes. Occasionally they spoke about zealots. And this was a terminology that was fairly normative, and it meant certain things to people. But when you looked at the scrolls themselves, they were more than that. And the idea of an Essene, as described, for instance, in the Jewish historian Josephus in the first century, or his earlier contemporary Philo of Alexandria, also in the earlier first century, who spoke about Essenes. When you looked at these people, they were not talking about Essenes vis-a-vis any Messiah situation. But if you look at the Qumran, is the word we use to describe Dead Sea Scrolls, because it's an easier jargon, it's where they were discovered. If you look at the Qumran documents, you'll see that they are full of Messianic materials. They have all of the so-called Messianic prophecies. They have collections of Messianic proof texts, promises, for instance, to the seed of David, and things like that. So things that we've come laterally after Christianity came into play in the Roman Empire and Christian documents took over the Western worldview, prophecies that we became familiar with as sort of proof texts, you find in these lists in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I began to call this the literature of the Messianic movement in Palestine. And that's why I use that phrase, not Essene, not zealot, because I don't think they called themselves zealots. And we've never seen Essene used anywhere but Josephus and Philo. We don't even have it in the New Testament documents. So what were they calling themselves? And there are many names, but I think the whole literature is the literature of, because of these Messianic quotes, the literature of the Messianic movement in Palestine. The key prophecy that we're talking about when we're speaking about the Messianic movement in Palestine is usually the star prophecy. It's from Numbers, I think it's Numbers 24. A star will rise from Jacob, a scepter to rule the world, etc., etc., etc. Often, for instance, in Christian iconography, you see the star over Bethlehem. If you go to the catacombs in Rome, you'll see Balaam, who's the prophet in Numbers, who is supposed to have first uttered this prophecy, pointing at the star in the actual catacombs. So the fundamental one was the star prophecy, because of this star will rise out of Jacob, a scepter to rule the world. Now this is in Josephus. Josephus says that this was capable of, the first century Jewish historian, of multiple interpretations, and he, like rabbinic Judaism to follow him, represents, let's say, the Pharisee approach. He said he used the most cynical interpretation. He applied it to the rise of the Roman emperor in Palestine, the Roman emperor that destroyed the Jewish independent state in Palestine, that burned the temple and so on and so forth. He said he's the world ruler that would come out of Palestine. And therefore, he in return got the moniker Flavius Josephus, because the new emperors that came out of Palestine, the Roman generals, Vespasian and Titus and so on, the Arch of Titus in Rome is still extant, these people were called Flavians. So in return for his cynical interpretation and sycophantism, he becomes Flavius Josephus. But Christianity, for instance, has this star prophecy as applying to their picture of Jesus. And in the scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the star prophecy is referred to in at least three extant documents. One we call the Damascus document, one we call the War Scroll, and in this list of messianic proof texts that I said. That's quite incredible to have three. And Josephus at one moment in his Jewish war book says that the thing that most moved the Jews to revolt against Rome was the prophecy that a world ruler would come out of Palestine. So, in other words, the war against Rome was a messianic war. So that's why I say that the scrolls are not only the literature of the messianic movement in Palestine, they're also the literature of the war against Rome. And you do have in this war scroll, it's in around, the scrolls are divided into columns because they're read from right to left and so on in the normal Hebrew way because they're rolled on a scroll. So around column 11 or so in the war scroll, you have this prophecy, and then they interpret it. And they interpret it in terms of the Messiah, and they also interpret it on, in terms of the heavenly host coming on the clouds of heaven to rain judgment on all the world. Now, if you look in the New Testament, every time Jesus or John the Baptist or someone like that, in early church literature, James, the brother of Jesus, is questioned, they speak about, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, meaning with the heavenly host for whatever they're supposed to do, rain judgment on the earth. And so I say that here's the war scroll giving its Palestinian version of these ideas, and then in Christianity later, you have the reformulation as they're presented in the Gospels as we know them. Well, can this Messiah be called the Christ? The Christ is a very ephemeral Greek terminology that very few people know what it actually meant. Christos in Greek can mean compassion. In some versions, I suppose it can mean anointed one. I've never seen how that actually works out, because this is a very precise Greek transcription. But one thing is sure, the book of Acts, which describes the development of the church in its own somewhat tendentious manner, at least the first 15 chapters, speaks around 10, 11 or so on, that Christians were first called Christians in Paul's church in Antioch in northern Syria somewhere, There's a lot of discussion on which Antioch that is. I don't think we need to get into that here. It's very technical, but the head of the Seleucid Empire, which is where all these Antiochs were, there are at least four or five of them, his father was named Antiochus, or Antiochus. And so he named lots of cities after him. So the question is, which one are we talking about? Which Antioch is Paul's Antioch? But in any case, that means in the mid-50s, when this is supposed to be happening in the book of Acts, Christians were first called Christians at Antioch. That means they weren't called Christians in Palestine. That means in the 30s, 40s, or whatever, certainly probably up to, because it would take quite a long time for that terminology then to permeate back into Palestine, if that's an accurate presentation. That means they weren't called Christians in Palestine until quite late, even probably until the war against Rome and thereafter. So what were they called? That's a Greek formulation. So I don't know if Christ is a perfect translation of Messiah, or whether Christians were ever called Christians in Palestine until much later. So we have to ask, what were they called? And I think they were called, well, Messianists, perhaps, but perhaps Ebionites. Ebion is the Hebrew word for poor, and the poor are mentioned in the war scroll. The Dead Sea Scrolls talk about themselves in terms of the poor. The James community was called the Ebionites, the poor. The letter of James addresses the poor. And so that may have been one of the names. There's one early church historian. His name's called Hippolytus. There's a manuscript that was found attributed to him in Mount Athos in the 19th century that was just recently found. We don't know if it was to him, but he has a version of the Jewish sects there, very much like Josephus, but slightly different than Josephus. And he speaks about there being four groups of Essenes, not one as in Josephus, but four. And two of these groups he calls Zealot Essenes and Sicarii Essenes. Now, I think that's more like what the Dead Sea Scrolls were, that the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit Essene characteristics, Zealot characteristics, and Messianic characteristics. And Sicarii was a word is found in the book of Acts 2. It's the Greek word for assassin or terrorist. And Josephus, who's writing in Greek, likes to call the extreme nationalist partisan zealot groups Sicarii, assassins. But they certainly didn't call themselves this. So that's a pejorative, again, being used, and so you have to say, who are the Sicarii? In Josephus, the Sicarii actually are the ones who commit suicide on Masada when the whole revolution against Rome fails. And in the New Testament, you have this odd character, who we have recently found a gospel in his name, called Judas Iscariot. And people, you just transpose the I and the S, and you get Sicarios. And that's the closest thing that we have there to his name. So it's pretty clear to a lot of us that that's a parody of Judas the Zealot, Judas the Sicarii, etc. And that, of course, he's portrayed in the most negative way, except in the New Gospel attributed to him, where there seems to be a somewhat reportrayal of him and so on. So I don't know when Christ or Christian came into play. It's very late, it's overseas, it's Greek. If it's a precise translation of something, I don't know. But in Palestine, these are the groups we have. The poor, the Ebionites, the Essenes, the Zealots, the Essene Zealots, the Zealot Essenes, the Sicarii Essenes, and so on and so forth. One last point I'd like to make on that particular subject. Josephus says the Essenes participated in the war against Rome. Now, in his description of Essenes, you wouldn't get any idea, because most people think of Essenes as retiring monastic sort of people. They weren't this, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were very active and not retiring, and they were aggressive and not self-effacing and so on. Militant, I would say. So he said they didn't mind dying any kind of death. They withstood any kind of torture. In other words, they were the first martyrs, just like early Christianity says Christians were. They were the first martyrs. And they would not take the name, call any man Lord, or eat any forbidden things. Hippolytus says The same thing, except he's speaking about the Zealot Essenes or the Sicarii Essenes. And he says the same thing, that they would withstand any torture, go to their death, any kind of thing like that. But they would not eat things sacrificed to idols rather than for forbidden things. Well, if you look at early Christian literature and you look at the book of Acts again, Acts 15, where the so-called Jerusalem Council is taking place, the final rulings by James are abstain from things sacrificed to idols. Now, that is something James is portrayed as disseminating to the whole of early Christianity from his leadership in Jerusalem. Now, you look at Paul, 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, he's heaping abuse on those people who abstain from things sacrificed to idols. He knows that eating and not eating, or prohibiting eating things sacrificed to idols, is a very important thing. And therefore, he starts arguing all through 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 about this stricture from, obviously, from James, whom he opposes. And he says, oh, an idol is nothing in the world. You know, these people's consciences are weak. So because they have such weak consciences, you know, you're eating such things in front of them might cause them to stumble. I'm paraphrasing here. So when you're around them, don't do that, because you don't want to cause your brother to stumble. But as for me, later on in the same letter, he says, there are no forbidden things. Eat anything in the butcher shops. He also says some of these people in Romans, in the other letter, are so weak that they'll only eat vegetables. So this is how he talks about this. And it shows that things sacrificed to idols and not eating them, which Josephus says, or rather Josephus says, is what they were really not going to eat, is extremely important, and kind of ties all these things together. Well, yes, the word Christ or Christians can refer to the Palestine Messianic movement, but it's a later term that has been used overseas in northern Syria, the book of Acts, that describes its version of the growth of what it calls the church, says Christians were first called Christians in Antioch in Syria. Now, that is not a revolutionary movement in Antioch in Syria. That's a Pauline church. They would be opposed, basically, to the Messianic movement in Palestine. They would be transforming it into something quite different, a pacifist, pro-Roman sort of Messianic movement that we're now all familiar with. So it isn't the same as the Messianic movement in Palestine. It's a later reformulation of the Messianic movement in Palestine. So yes, it can certainly originally refer to that, but that's not what it became, because the Pauline community in Antioch is very different from whatever could have been considered the Dead Sea Scrolls, the James community in Jerusalem, or anything like that.
Excellent. So let's move on to why the Jews rebelled from Rome in 66 CE. Were there statues that were trying to be placed in the temples and they didn't believe in that?
Well, there was a revolt of the Jews ultimately in 66 CE or AD, depending on how you like to describe these dates. And as Josephus, the Jewish historian, puts it in the one revealing portion at the end of his book called The Jewish War, he says the thing that most moved the Jews' revolt against Rome was an obscure prophecy from among their writings that a world ruler would come out of Palestine. Well, we recognize that as what the Christian religion considers its Christ or Christianity founder to be. Josephus himself says in his own cynical way that they were mistaken about this, that it actually applied to the destroyer of the Jewish people in Palestine and the destroyer of the Jewish temple, the future emperor Vespasian and his son Titus, who everyone knows from the Arch of Titus in Rome, where is pictured all the prisoners and booty from the war of 66. Now, this war in 66 went on from 66 to 70 AD, and actually the final stages of it are also described in Josephus. in the Masada, which people have heard of, the Masada episode, which is a sort of a plateau or a one of those geographical features you see in Arizona and places, a sort of mesa, yeah, a mesa.
Say that statement one more time from the beginning.
Yeah, which is this Masada is really a sort of mesa of the kind you're familiar with in places like Arizona, on which was built a palace, a step palace, but also it had storage bins and things like that. And he pictures the zealots, but the most extreme wing of the zealots, one of the Jewish parties, he considers, Josephus that is, responsible for the war against Rome, the Sicarii. This is where the Sicarii retreat to. Sicarii is a Greek term. It's named after the knife, supposedly, that he says they carried under their vestments to assassinate their opponents. That's Josephus, who is already prejudiced because he's gone over to the Roman side. But that would be like the curved dagger Arabs even wear to this day. They maybe have used these in various ways. But I'm sure they didn't call themselves Sicarii. That's a pejorative. But on this Masada, they're the ones who commit suicide with all their families and children and everyone else rather than surrender to Rome. So that's the last stage of the war against Rome, 73 AD. So this war against Rome is 66 to 70. The temple is destroyed. There's a lot of discussion who did it, but clearly the Romans did it, burned it in 70 AD, and then it continues out in the Dead Sea area at Masada. But I think there's some numerology here. That 66, if you look at it carefully, is 3.5 years after the death of James in 62. And I feel that the death of in my work, I have described a sequentiality in these things, that you have these Sicarii or extreme zealots assassinating collaborating priests. So, for instance, the picture in the New Testament, the Gospels, of the high priests and so on condemning Jesus with the Roman authorities, etc., doesn't show you that the people, the general populace, was against this establishment. It shows, it uses this as a way of blaming the Jews in some way for the death of their Savior and so on. And it doesn't give you the picture of unrest and disaffection that existed in the general population. So the sequentiality is the assassination of one of these priests, the son of the priest pictured in the Gospels as taking part in the trial of Jesus. His name is Ananias, his name, and this one was called Jonathan. Then he's assassinated. Then there is a retribution on the Sicarii, probably, I think, the stoning of James, which follows that. Then the fire in Rome, which follows that. And then Nero's using of the fire in Rome, supposedly in Christian history, to incriminate Christians, but which is actually incriminating these messianic zealot type people who are probably using the fire in Rome to answer the death of people like their leader, righteous people like James. And then this attempt by Nero to exacerbate the situation in Palestine and to force the Jews to revolt against Rome so he could suppress and destroy them. That's the sequentiality I see. So the 3.5 years after the death of James is the year 66 where the lower priesthood stops sacrifice on behalf of the Roman emperor in the temple, which is the signal for the uprising against Rome. And that's a popular uprising across the board, except for establishment collaborationist groups. Collaborationist groups meaning the Herodians, the Herod family put in power in Palestine by the Romans. The Sadducees meaning the Romanizing and Herodian high priests, not the Dead Sea Scrolls or Jesus type of high priests, James type of high priests, and the Pharisees, who are pictured as ultimately their leader, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in the Talmud, is pictured as also, like Josephus, proclaiming Vespasian as a Messiah that would come out of Palestine to rule the world. And in return for that, not like Josephus, he wasn't made a Flavian. He was given a rabbinic academy in what's called Jabne to found rabbinic Judaism. So, but this 66 is a very important date. The fire in Rome, which is part of a sequentiality that I've already tried to elucidate in my work, we don't know who caused it. The Christian literature says Nero caused it. A lot of Roman literature does too. Nero claims the Christian caused it. We don't know who the Christians were in Rome at that time. Are they Jewish zealots? Are they Pauline Christians, as they've come to be called? If they're Pauline Christians, they're not involved in setting fires. But if they're Jewish apocalyptic zealots or extremist Sicarii zealot Essenes, like the early church historian Hippolytus speaks about, they could have and would have perhaps done this. So in my mind, you want me to say definitely, or you're asking me definitely, or one is, I have to say that again. I'm being asked definitely whether this was caused by these extremist Jewish zealot type groups in Rome. You can't be sure who caused it. It's not clear, but they could have done it, yes. It could have been a response, a sequential response, first to the assassination of the collaborating high priest in the 50s, then the stoning of James in the early 60s, then the fire in Rome, then following this, the Jewish revolt in Palestine. Rome was certainly afraid of this messianic movement, not only in Palestine, but elsewhere in the Mediterranean world. We know that these people went out into other parts of the Mediterranean world. We know there were areas in northern Syria, which is not necessarily totally under Roman control at this time. The Persians and the Romans are contesting that area. But also North Africa, we know that there's a church in Egypt. We know that there's unrest in Egypt. We know Cyrenaica. Luke in the book of Acts in the New Testament supposedly comes from Cyrenaica, Lucius of Cyrene, which is present-day Libya. We know that after the war against Rome, the extreme zealots called the Sicarii and Josephus moved down to Egypt. We know the Romans follow them there. We know that they burned this other temple that existed in Egypt at that time. They saw the temple and these groups as part of this unrest. We know there were other revolts in Cyrenaica that followed that. We know there were revolts in 115 that were put down in Egypt, and the Jewish community in Egypt was virtually wiped out. We know this from the papyrus trash heaps there. We know finally that there was the second Jewish revolt in 132 to 136 under Hadrian's period, which was more horrific than perhaps the one in 66 to 70, but there was no Josephus to catalog it in the way we have it cataloged in the earlier time in Josephus, so we don't know as much about it, but it was as devastating or more. So were the Romans afraid of this movement? Yes, the Romans were terribly afraid of this movement. Would they rather have it defanged, pacified, turned into something that was not as threatening? Yes, certainly they would have preferred such a thing. Was there a Roman secret service? Was there a Roman intelligence organization? Were there people in Rome who understood how these things were operating? I don't know, but there were very knowledgeable people in Rome. There were Herodian family members who were connected to the Roman establishment, both in Palestine and in Rome. There were the very famous philosopher Seneca, that was Nero's tutor. We have an apocryphal correspondence between Paul and Seneca. We have Paul meeting Seneca's brother in the book of Acts in Corinth in Greece, a governor called Gallio. We know that Nero, was it Nero? Yes, forced Seneca to commit suicide at one point, and so on. We have people who are very knowledgeable, and so I don't know. It just seems to me that when Paul and Josephus ultimately go to Rome, they don't get free in any way unless they are turned, unless they become Roman instruments in some way. Josephus certainly becomes a Roman instrument after he goes to Rome in the 50s. He describes that he went to Rome on an appeal to Caesar. Paul also has an appeal to Caesar in the book of Acts. Something odd happens in Rome. We don't know what. He isn't seen maltreated according to Acts. And Acts leaves off before it tells us what happens to him. In some versions of things, there are characters very much like Paul that return to Palestine at some point in the early 60s and are sort of intermediaries. A character in Josephus called Saulus, who I make a lot of in my work, Saul, Saulus, Paul, and so on, who's an Herodian family member. I make a lot of him in my James, the Brother of Jesus, in my New Testament code book, so people can read about that if they want. But yes, I think that there were people that were ready to work for Rome in these early movements, and the pacification of the Messianic movement was very important to Rome. Last point on that. In Romans 13, Paul says, the ruling authorities were placed here by God's will. Therefore, it's God's will that they are here. You should obey God's will. You should obey the ruling authorities. Well, you couldn't get a more, of course, it's a letter to the Romans. You couldn't get a more pro-Roman statement than that. And he goes on to say, and actually, you should pay your taxes to these authorities. Now, the tax question was the burning question in Palestine, over which these revolutionary movements began 50, 60, 70 years before. He says, yes, you should pay your taxes, and the wearing of the sword will bring its own reward. And he bases this in the next phrases in Romans 13 on one of the favorite passages of these Dead Sea Scroll type, Jesus type, Messianic leader type statements. That is, because you should love your neighbor as yourself. You couldn't have a more cynical interpretation of the famous love your neighbor as yourself, what's called the righteousness commandment, as that includes paying your tax to Rome because they are your neighbors and you should love them as yourself. You couldn't get more cynical. But you see, I'm not a great supporter of Paul. He says some things that are really quite worrisome if you look at them carefully and not just as an awestruck person of faith.
Thank you. For our viewers, we have time
A lot of people are not really familiar with the Herodian family. They see King Herod as great. We are calling him Herod the Great. They see King Herod as a Jewish king. This is preposterous. This shows how little historical information is actually being conveyed in the Gospels. Of course, we're not really dealing much with King Herod, except that all the members of the Herod family became called Herod, like all the members of the Caesar family, it became called Caesar in time. So it's very confusing to readers of the Gospels and the book of Acts who the Herod is that they're talking about. But the first Herod, the King Herod, the one who died around 4 century or the turn of 4 BC or the turn of the eras, he was an Idumean Arab. And it's quite clear from the genealogies and so on that his father was a priest of Apollo, or his grandfather, from the city of Ashkelon, Gaza area. Today, that's still called those names. And that he had been either taken prisoner or taken over to Petra, which is in the Arab Transjordan area as it is now. And his mother was from Petra, was Arab background. So this is not a born Jewish family in any way, shape, or form. I'm not hurting the Arabs. It's an Arab family. And how are they king of the Jews? How do they become Judean kings? Because when the Romans conquered Palestine, they were looking for people who were aiding them, abetting them. And it turned out that Herod's father was one of the intermediaries who participated in the Roman conquest of Palestine under Caesar's opponent, Pompey, in 63 BC, when the temple was first stormed by Romans. So Herod's father was in that process of bringing Roman troops into Palestine, and as such he became the first governor of Palestine. And Josephus describes that these people became Roman citizens in perpetuity, his whole family. So all Herodians were Roman citizens. There later on, three or four generations later, you get Paul or Silas. He's got a Roman citizenship. How has he got a Roman citizenship? In my work, that doesn't prove it, but one of the aspects of his being from this family is that this is the reason he has a Roman citizenship. I'm sure Jesus didn't pull out a Roman citizenship. I'm sure James didn't pull out a Roman citizenship. I'm sure none of these people had Roman citizenships, only someone like Paul. He came from a very upper-class family, probably of Herodian background. So who were the Herodians? They were a Greco-Arab family, somewhat possibly Judaized, though only Judaized when it was convenient to please the subjects they were given, who were put in power in Palestine and destroyed the previous Jewish ruling family, the Maccabean family, root and stalk, even though they used some of them to climb to power. So they Josephus describes how Herod destroyed his grandfather-in-law, who he had married a Maccabean princess, Herod did. He destroyed her father. He had her executed. He had his own children by her executed. He had her brother executed. He killed everyone in the family and destroyed the Jewish Maccabean family, who were the Jewish heroes of the resistance that the Hanukkah family, that the Hanukkah celebration is presently celebrated after. So who were the Herodians in Palestine? They were a Roman puppet rulership in Palestine, and the Romans used them elsewhere. They were perfect Roman civil servants. They used them in Asia Minor. They used them in northern Syria. They put them in kingships in Armenia. They put them in lots of different places. They were what the Romans would call kings of the peoples. That is, in the East, the peoples were not part of the Roman Empire. They were little separate kingdoms. And often families like the Herodians were put in power. But these were people with total Roman allegiances. Actually, I had a professor when I was young at college who used to say poetry was truer than history. And I think basically he was right about that. It isn't what actually happened that really matters. It's what people believe happened. And the beliefs are in the old myths or in the old Greek legends or in the old Greek stories. Somewhat he was applying it to that. But it's also in things like the Christian and somewhat even in the Jewish Bible. It's what the myth, what the poetry says that matters, not what actually happened. So each new generation, whatever you say, is going to hear the myth. And that's what is true for them. And what follows is the actual history is much too complex for the average person to ever get their head around. The question of Jesus' existence is a very difficult one. I mean, people have been arguing about it since Albert Schweitzer's time and before. It's known as the quest for the historical Jesus. The point is, something what I was just talking about, poetry being truer than history. The poetry is very powerful. People love elements of the story that they're presented with. It's something that they believe in, they care about, and they live their lives by it. The poetry for Christianity is in the Gospels, the four Gospels. In fact, if there's a competitive Gospel, like the Gospel of Judas that recently surfaced, that's rejected outright by the down-the-line believers. So it's in the Gospels. The poetry is there. So I don't think that Jesus can be historically defended. I don't think there's any evidence that we can extend to that particular Jesus. I say to my students and other associates and friends that actually the best evidence for the existence of Jesus is the fact that he had a brother called James. Now, we can document pretty good a lot of things about James, because the material about James hasn't been mythologized to the same extent. It hasn't been overwritten with other people's ideas to the same extent. You know, in Islamic tradition, we have the Quran and so on, and then you have what's called the Hadith literature. That would be the poetry. Hadith is like news about the Prophet. Hadith means news, like gospel literature. A vast literature of almost a huge amount of sayings being put into the Prophet's mouth, some of which people say is authentic, a lot of which is inauthentic, people think. Western people. Muslims, of course, are like Orthodox Christians. They take it all as authentic. So the Gospels are like that, are like a Hadith literature. The question is, how much of that can you rely on? Well, let me give two passages that I think, you know, show some of the character of this. Some of the, what we call the synoptic gospels, the three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that more or less resemble each other, John being somewhat different in some aspects and historical development line. You have this passage where Jesus, I say is pictured, because I think that's all it is, a picture. Spits in people's eyes in order to cure them of blindness, or on their tongues, or in their ears, or however it is to cure them of being deaf and dumb, or something like that. Now, look, those are the characteristics of Hellenistic, you know, sort of literature, healer kind of, I think, mythological characters. I don't think any of us in the modern 21st century want our Messiah to be spitting on people's tongues in order to stop them from being tongue-tied or something, or spitting in their ears to stop them from being deaf and dumb. Those are the characteristics of Hellenistic literature. For instance, Jesus at one point in the same sequence, which is developing an attack on I think, Dead Sea Scrolls people. I can explain why, but I don't have time. But that same set of passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke develops into something where Jesus is presented in Mark as saying, he said these things declaring all foods clean. Now, declaring all foods clean is what Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians when he starts on the thing sacrificed to idols and finally ends up with, for me, there is nothing unlawful, all things are lawful. Eat all the food in the butcher shops. This is in the same passage where he's talking about not eating things sacrificed to idols. So these passages end up with Jesus saying, he said these things, declaring all foods clean. But in the process, he says, or he's pictured as saying, in these arguments with the so-called Pharisees and so on, you should actually not have to wash your hands before eating. He says this. Now, I don't think the historical Jesus ever said any such thing. Why is he saying this? Because it's an attack on Jewish Palestinian law of the Pauline type. So that is basically a Pauline position being retrospectively put into the mouth of the historical Jesus. For instance, how does he say this? He says, well, there are commandments of God and there are the traditions of men. That's from Talmudic material, the traditions of men. And he says, one of the traditions of men is you should wash your hands before eating. But you see, a tradition from God is honor your parents. Honor your parents. That's part of the Ten Commandments. Well, Your parents didn't wash their hands before eating, going out to the Gentile world to preach Christianity as we know it. Therefore, you shouldn't have to either, because that's a commandment from God, and the commandment to wash your hands is only a commandment of men. Well, to my mind, this is a totally specious, what we would call in Platonic philosophy, an ad hominem argument. The groups that Plato is attacking, the sophists, the sophistry, would argue in this manner. And I don't think any of us now would say, oh, you shouldn't wash your hands before eating. So, you know, those are things I wouldn't attribute to the historical Jesus. So what about the sayings in the Gospels? Can we rely on them? I'm not sure. I don't think we can. I think a lot of them have been affected by retrospective party strife, Pauline theology. And I think that as far as the presentation of the Jesus character, it's somewhat of a composite of many messianic leaders of the time. Many messianic leaders of the time, most or all of whom came to a bad end, usually by crucifixion, because crucifixion was the Roman punishment for seditious activity. Now, a lot of people don't realize that the Jews forbade crucifixion. It was in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's specifically condemned. It's specifically condemned as something that is an affront to God, that you cannot crucify people because you should not hang a man up alive. That's in a document called the Nahum Commentary in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's a specific answer to those things in the Gospels, implying that the Jews either approved of crucifixion or were involved in crucifixion. Crucifixion was a Roman punishment, the first evidence of which you see in the Spartacus uprising in the 80s BC period, when after Spartacus the gladiator led his gladiatorial followers in these terrible battles against Rome, when the Romans finally triumphed, they crucified people from all the way from Rome to Naples. And this is pictured by the Roman historians as a horrible. They left the bodies up there just to stink and rot for, you know, until they decayed. What is it? It's a message to the people. This is what's going to happen to you if you raise your hand against the might of Rome. So yes, it's a Roman punishment, and it's one of the instances there where the Gospels really can't be relied on in terms of any Jewish participation in this. And I'm not trying to get the Jews out of this, but the point is this the historical Jesus? Yes, there are innumerable messianic contenders, leaders, others crucified. I would say up to the war against Rome, there probably, and including the war against Rome, Josephus describes how he helps takes a few people down who were friends of his, the Romans were crucifying after they took Jerusalem. I would say there were literally hundreds of thousands of people crucified in Palestine from around 0 to about 70 AD and beyond. The only one we've ever heard of is this Jesus story. There are hundreds of thousands of revolutionary opponents and seditious people crucified in Roman Palestine, maybe 100,000 or so over that time span. And so the Jesus character, I think, yes, is a composite of many of these characters. But how much is historical? It's impossible to say, but there's very little contemporary testimony about this particular individual in this manner.
So what does the name Jesus mean?
The name Jesus is a Greekified, transliteration of the Hebrew name Joshua, which in Hebrew is Yehoshua, which gets shortened in conversations to Yeshua, and then over into Greek becomes Jesus in Greek transliteration. Joshua literally does, and he's presented as a kind of being, does mean Savior, he who saves. In the Joshua case, he who saves his people. In the Jesus case, he who saves the world. But it has a theological impact. Now, was there an actual Jesus person in Palestine? Well, there are lots of people with that name, but was there one crucified in this manner? Well, you will look in vain in Josephus, the contemporary historian, for such a presentation. There's one presentation that everyone considers to be a retrospective invention in Josephus. But was there such a person crucified? We don't know. Now, was Jesus called Jesus? Well, if you know your Gospels well, you will see the fact that he has four brothers. And the four brothers come with Mary, the mother, and they're called James, Simon, Jude, and Joses. If you actually look at the Greek, Joses in the Greek, J-S-S, and Jesus, J-S-S, really is basically the same Greek name. So we know a lot about James. We get to know over the course of time in the native Hebrew literature, I'm not talking about the Gospels now, a lot about Simon. I think we know a lot about Jude. Not only Jude, the brother of James in the New Testament, but Judas Iscariot, as presented in the New Testament, and others by that name. But Joses, we don't know anything about any Joses. I think that Joses is actually Jesus. But it could be Joshua, Joses, Josiah, I don't know what it's based on. But the point is, as the Jesus picture develops over the first century and maybe into the second, people haven't agreed how old the Gospels actually are, that what happens is that fathers become uncles, brothers become cousins, and I think people like Jesus himself, or I don't know how to put it, turns into his own brother, or vice versa, his own brother turns into him. In other words, this is a way of distancing physical members of the messianic family, if you want to call it that, or messianic families like this, away from the supernatural Christ. The supernatural Christ is the basis of what Christianity becomes in overseas communities like the Pauline community in Antioch in northern Syria, where Christians were first called Christians according to Acts. The supernatural Christ is the basis, basically, of Paul's writings. Now, I don't think Jews ever believed in the supernatural Messiah as such. There are some indications of some supernatural aspects to the Messiah in the War Scroll. He says, because the War Scroll, when talking about the star prophecy, speaks about a prophecy about, and Assyria will fall by the hand of no mere man. And it goes on to talk about this no mere man. So there are some hints at that. But normally speaking, the Jews weren't talking about a supernatural being, and certainly not a godlike being. So as the supernatural Christ idea in the Greco-Hellenistic Roman world develops, the members of the family get pushed further and further away, and I think actually Jesus turns into his own brother. So I don't know what the physical Jesus was, and I don't know, I can't give you any information about his historical existence. But I have said that who and whatever James was, Jesus' alleged closest relative and successor, even in the Gospels and the New Testament and the book of Acts and the letters, so was Jesus. So I have in my work tried to do this. Look for the historical James in order to find the historical Jesus. In other words, like in American history, do you think that Robert Kennedy was very different in his ideas from John Kennedy, or Edward Kennedy very different, and so on? A little bit, but probably not totally opposite. They upheld the family tradition, whatever the first ones were. So the second and third tried to follow that. The same with this family. So if you can find the historical James, you can find the historical Jesus. But if you try to find him through the historical Paul, who admits to being the enemy of early Christianity in Palestine, to have persecuted early Christianity in Palestine, even to have put some to death, and is pictured in Acts as leading riots against early Christians, so-called Christians, in Palestine. If you try to find him in that literature, through the enemy, if you like, of early Christianity in Palestine's point of view, I think you can't find him. What you're finding in his literature, as he himself says, is someone he calls Christ Jesus. In his letters, he's the first one to use that term, Christ Jesus. And for him, Christ Jesus is a supernatural being. Christ Jesus is in heaven, and giving him personal, Christ Jesus is in heaven, and giving him personal revelations. And he considers himself to have a personal contact with this supernatural Christ in heaven who has appointed him an apostle, as he calls it, an apostle to the Gentiles. The beginning of Galatians. I, Paul, an apostle not by men, i.e. not by the Jerusalem church, not by James, not carrying letters of appointment by James, but by Christ Jesus himself, that is direct appointment by the supernatural Christ, who he never saw, never encountered, and never met in his lifetime. So to my mind, a person of that kind is basically reflecting his own ideology when he speaks about these supernatural visions. And if you're looking for the historical Christ, you've got to look to these other people. So going back to the original point, who and whatever James was, so was Jesus. The Jews would have reacted to the portrayal of Jesus Christ in the gospel very, very, very negatively as he's portrayed in the gospel, because he's basically Paulinized, talking about things like don't wash your hands before eating, things of that kind, or paying the tax to Rome, very, very unpopular. So we know the whole war against Rome was based on not paying the taxes to Rome and so on. So surely that person would have been a very unpopular person who spoke those things, but he wouldn't have been greeted in the messianic ways portrayed in the Gospels as popular among the masses if he had doctrines of that kind. Which is why I say, if you want to find the doctrines of the historical Jesus in Palestine, go to the historical James, who was very popular. We know this from early church literature. We know this from other documents, like one called the Pseudo-Clementine Recognitions, that pictures the popularity of James in his time in Palestine. That is a kind of opposition Acts, very different from Acts. By the way, we have a Peter in the Pseudo-Clementine. They're called Pseudo-Clementines because the church has said they're pseudo, false writings under the name of Clement, but they're no more false than any other document. It's just that, doctrinally speaking, they're not acceptable. Anyway, we have a Peter in the Pseudo-Clementine Recognitions who is a gentle Peter, an Essene-type Peter, a Peter who wears threadbare clothes, a Peter who bathes every morning at dawn, just like the Essenes are portrayed as doing in Josephus and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and a Peter who never utters anti-Semitic statements, as the Peter in Acts is continually pictured as doing, and a Peter who is a total follower of James, who is totally not only subordinate to James, but honors all of James's instructions. These people, like Peter, or as pictured in the Pseudo-Clementine Recognitions, not in the Book of Acts, or someone like James, were very popular in Palestine. And I believe the Essene Zealot movements were very popular in Palestine.
Can you describe your personal struggle in getting important information about the Dead Sea Scrolls to the public?
Well, the struggle over the freeing of the Dead Sea Scroll was very difficult, only because of the entrenched positions that people had in different areas of the debate. I personally hadn't known that the scrolls were not all revealed until very late in my teaching career at California State University, Long Beach. It wasn't clear to me. It was only after speaking to several scholars of different kinds that I discovered that most of the materials of the scrolls hadn't yet been published or were even available to the public. So when I was a National Endowment for the Endowments Fellow at the Albright Institute of Archaeology in Israel, Palestine, it was on the Jordanian, Jerusalem, East Jerusalem side, so it might have been called Palestine at that time. When I was a National Endowments for the Humanities researcher associate there, I had come to work on the community of James and the Dead Sea Scrolls community. And there was literally nothing I could do there because of the fact that the scrolls were unpublished. So that's when I began this campaign to try to open up all the scrolls so everyone could work on them and not just see them through the tendentious view of one set of scholars who had control of them, mostly under the authority of certain church members in Palestine, but some academic people at Harvard and other places like that. Well, some people may consider what I was doing heroic. It was only heroic because of the defamation that occurred in the process of trying to do this. I mean, we were not doing anything wrong. We were just trying to open up these materials to public scrutiny and so every scholar could approach them individually and not be under anyone's authority. And also we wanted, in the old Chinese phraseology, let a thousand voices sing. But the reaction and the, I consider, in fact, vitriolic defamation was so strong in some areas that it looked like we were being heroic in some manner. We certainly didn't feel heroic at the time, but in retrospect, some of the vindictiveness makes one feel that it was a somewhat courageous struggle. The scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls produced this vitriol among certain quarters of the academic community because people had their whole scholarly reputations tied up in their interpretations and still do. The what we call scholarly cabals or scholarly consensuses have reformed. We've hardly dented them, frankly. People are still being taught the absolute same things about the scrolls as they were before they were all out, because everything has reformed, because that's the way scholarly consensus or academic yay-saying fellowships work. It's sort of like a curia. You know, a certain doctrine takes hold, and if you don't ascribe to that doctrine, you don't get into the certain graduate programs, you don't get the doctor fathers, as they're called, the professors, to entertain your theses. Your theses are poorly reviewed in journals and so on and so forth. It extends very, very wide. In the scrolls, it had additional ramifications, like in this book here, The Dead Sea Scrolls Uncovered, which we printed some of the first stock.